pale green or silver in the wind, and the rustle of their innumerable leaves is a spell of music. Day and night would flicker by uncounted, while still I stood knee-deep in grass and listened. There I was enchanted, and forgot the sea in my heart. There I wandered, naming new flowers, or lay a dream amid the singing of the birds and the humming of bees and flies. And there I might still dwell in delight, forsaking all my kin, whether the ships of the Teleri or the swords of the Noldor. But my doom would not so. Or the Lord of Waters himself, may be, for he was strong in that land. Thus it came into my heart to make a raft of willow boughs and move upon the bright bosom of Sirion. And so I did, and so I was taken. For on a day, as I was in the midst of the river, a sudden wind came and caught me, and bore me away out of the land of willows down to the sea. Thus I came last of the messengers to Círdan, and of the 7 ships that he built at Turgon's asking, all but one were then full wrought, and one by one they set sail into the west. And none yet has ever returned, nor has any news of them been heard. But the salt air of the sea now stirred anew the heart of my mother's kin within me, and I rejoiced in the waves, learning all ship lore, as were it already stored in the mind. So when the last ship, and the greatest, was made ready, I was eager to be gone, saying within my thought, "If the words of the Noldor be true, then in the west there are meads with which the land of willows cannot compare. There is no withering, nor any end of spring, and perhaps even I, Voronwë, may come thither. And at the worst, to wander on the waters is better far than the shadow in the north." And I feared not, for the ships of the Teleri no water may drown. But the great sea is terrible, Tuor, son of Huor, and it hates the Noldor, for it works the doom of the Valar. Worse things it holds than to sink into the abyss and so perish. Loathing and loneliness and madness, terror of wind and tumult and silence, and shadows where all hope is lost and all living shapes pass away. And many shores evil and strange it washes, and many islands of danger and fear infest it. I will not darken your heart, son of Middle-earth, with the tale of my labour 7 years in the great sea from the north even into the south, but never to the west. For that is shut against us. At the last, in black despair, weary of all the world, we turned and fled from the doom that so long had spared us, only to strike us more cruelly. For even as we descried a mountain from afar, and I cried, "Lo, there is Taras, the land of my birth," the wind awoke, and great clouds thunder-laden came up from the west. Then the waves hunted us like living things filled with malice, and the lightning smote us, and when we were broken down to a helpless hull, the seas leaped upon us in fury. But as you see, I was spared. For it seemed to me that there came a wave, greater and yet calmer than all the others, and it took me and lifted me from the ship, and bore me high upon its shoulders, and rolling to the land it cast me upon the turf, and then drained away, pouring back over the cliff in a great waterfall. There but 1 hour had I sat when you came upon me, still dazed by the sea, and still I feel the fear of it, and the bitter loss of all my friends that went with me so long and so far, beyond the sight of mortal lands. Voronwë sighed, and spoke then softly as if to himself. But very bright were the stars upon the margin of the world, when at times the clouds about the west were drawn aside. Yet whether we saw only clouds still more remote, or glimpsed indeed, as some held, the mountains of the Pelori about the lost strands of our long home, I know not. Far, far away they stand, and none from mortal lands shall come there ever again, I deem. Then Voronwë fell silent, for night had come, and the stars shone white and cold. Soon after, Tuor and Voronwë arose and turned their backs toward the sea, and set out upon their long journey in the dark, of which there is little to tell, for the shadow of Ulmo was on Tuor, and none saw them pass, by wood or stone, by field or fen, between the setting and the rising of the sun. But ever warily they went, shunning the night-eyed hunters of Morgoth, and forsaking the trodden ways of elves and men. Voronwë chose their path, and Tuor followed. He asked no vain questions, but noted well that they went ever eastward along the march of the rising mountains, and turned never southward, at which he wondered, for he believed, as did well-nigh all elves and men, that Turgon dwelt far from the battles of the north. Slow was their going by twilight or by night in the pathless wilds, and the fell winter came down swiftly from the realm of Morgoth. Despite the shelter of the hills, the winds were strong and bitter, and soon the snow lay deep upon the heights, or whirled through the passes, and fell upon the woods of Nuath, ere the full shedding of their withered leaves. Thus, though they set out before the middle of Narquellier, the Hissime came in with biting frost, even as they drew nigh to the sources of Narog. There at the end of a weary night in the grey of dawn they halted, and Voronwë was dismayed, looking about him in grief and fear. Where once the fair pool of Ivrin had lain in its great stone basin carved by falling waters, and all about it had been a tree-clad hollow under the hills, now he saw a land defiled and desolate. The trees were burned or uprooted, and the stone marges of the pool were broken, so that the waters of Ivrin strayed and wrought a great barren marsh amid the ruin. All now was but a welter of frozen mire, and a reek of decay lay like a foul mist upon the ground. "Alas, has the evil come even here?" Voronwë cried. "Once far from the threat of Angband was this place, but ever the fingers of Morgoth grope further." "It is even as Ulmo spoke to me," said Tuor. "The springs are poisoned, and my power withdraws from the waters of the land." "Yet," said Voronwë, "a malice has been here with strength greater than that of orcs. Fear lingers in this place." And he searched about the edges of the mire, until suddenly he stood still and cried again, "Yea, a great evil!" And he beckoned to Tuor, and Tuor coming saw a slot like a huge furrow that passed away southward, and at either side, now blurred, now sealed hard and clear by frost, the marks of great clawed feet. "See," said Voronwë, and his face was pale with dread and loathing. "Here not long since was the great worm of Angband, most fell of all the creatures of the enemy. Late already is our errand to Turgon. There is need of haste." Even as he spoke thus, they heard a cry in the woods, and they stood still as grey stones, listening. But the voice was a fair voice, though filled with grief, and it seemed that it called ever upon a name, as one that searches for another who is lost. And as they waited, one came through the trees, and they saw that he was a tall man, armed, clad in black, with a long sword drawn. And they wondered, for the blade of the sword also was black, but the edges shone bright and cold. Woe was graven in his face, and when he beheld the ruin of Ivrin, he cried aloud in grief, saying, "Ivrin, Fail Ivrin, Gwyndor and Beleg, here once I was healed, but now never shall I drink the draught of peace again." Then he went swiftly away towards the north, as one in pursuit or on an errand of great haste, and they heard him cry, "Fail Ivrin, Finduilas," until his voice died away in the woods. But they knew not that Nargothrond had fallen, and this was Turin, son of Húrin the Black Sword. Thus only for a moment, and never again, did the paths of those kinsmen, Túrin and Túor, draw together. When the Black Sword had passed, Túor and Varonwë held on their way for a while, though day had come. For the memory of his grief was heavy upon them, and they could not endure to remain beside the defilement of Ivrin. But before long they sought a hiding place, for all the land was filled now with a foreboding of evil. They slept little and uneasily, and as the day wore it grew dark and a great snow fell, and with the night came a grinding frost. Thereafter the snow and ice relented not at all, and for 5 months the fell winter, long remembered, held the north in bonds. Now Túor and Varonwë were tormented by the cold, and feared to be revealed by the snow to hunting enemies, or to fall into hidden dangers treacherously cloaked. 9 days they held on, ever slower and more painfully, and Varonwë turned somewhat north until they crossed the 3 well streams of Teiglin, and then he bore eastward again, leaving the mountains, and went warily until they passed Glithuwy and came to the stream of Malduin, and it was frozen black. Then Túor said to Varonwë, "Fell is this frost, and death draws near to me, if not to you." For they were now in evil case. It was long since they had found any food in the wild, and the waybread was dwindling, and they were cold and weary. "Ill is it to be trapped between the doom of the Valar and the malice of the enemy," said Varonwë. "Have I escaped the mouths of the sea but to lie under the snow?" But Túor said, "How far is now to go? For at last, Varonwë, you must forego your secrecy with me. Do you lead me straight, and whither? For if I must spend my last strength, I would know to what that may avail." "I have led you as straight as I safely might," answered Varonwë. "Know then now that Turgon dwells still in the north of the land of the Eldar, though that is believed by few. Already we draw nigh to him, yet there are many leagues still to go, even as a bird might fly, and for us Sirion is yet to cross, and great evil, maybe, lies between. For we must come soon to the highway that ran of old down from the Minas of King Finrod to Nargothrond. There the servants of the enemy will walk and watch." "I counted myself the hardiest of men," said Túor, "and I have endured many winter's woe in the mountains. But I had a cave at my back and fire then, and I doubt now my strength to go much further thus hungry through the fell weather. But let us go on as far as we may before hope fails." "No other choice have we," said Varonwë, "unless it be to lay us down here and seek the snow sleep." Therefore all through that bitter day they toiled on, deeming the peril of foes less than the winter. But ever as they went they found less snow, for they were now going southward again down into the vale of Sirion, and the mountains of Dor Lomin were left far behind. In the deepening dusk they came to the highway at the bottom of a tall wooded bank. Suddenly they were aware of voices, and looking out warily from the trees they saw a red light below. A company of orcs was encamped in the midst of the road, huddled about a large wood fire.
"Gurth and Glamhoth, death to the orcs," Túor muttered. "Now the sword shall come from under the cloak. I will risk death for mastery of that fire, and even the meat of orcs would be a prize."
"Nay," said Varonwë, "on this quest only the cloak will serve. You must forego the fire, or else forego Turgon. This band is not alone in the wild. Cannot your mortal sight see the far flame of other posts to the north and to the south? A tumult will bring a host upon us. Hearken to me, Túor. It is against the law of the Hidden Kingdom that any should approach the gates with foes at their heels, and that law I will not break, neither for Ulmo's bidding nor for death. Rouse the orcs, and I leave you."
"Then let them be," said Túor. But may I live yet to see the day when I need not sneak aside from a handful of orcs like a cowed dog. Come then, said Voronwë. Debate no more, or they will scent us. Follow me. He crept then away through the trees, southward down the wind, until they were midway between that orc fire and the next upon the road. There he stood a long while, listening. I hear none moving on the road, he said, but we know not what may be lurking in the shadows. He peered forward into the gloom and shuddered. The air is evil, he muttered. Alas, yonder lies the land of our quest and hope of life, but death walks between. Death is all about us, said Tor, but I have strength left only for the shortest road. Here I must cross or perish. I will trust to the mantle of Ulmo, and you also it shall cover. Now I will lead. So saying, he stole to the border of the road. Then, clasping Voronwë close, he cast about them both the folds of the grey cloak of the Lord of Waters, and stepped forth. All was still. The cold wind sighed as it swept down the ancient road. Then suddenly it too fell silent. In the pause, Tuor felt a change in the air, as if the breath from the land of Morgoth had failed a while. And faint as a memory of the sea came a breeze from the west. As a grey mist on the wind, they passed over the stony street and entered a thicket on its eastern brink. All at once, from near at hand, there came a wild cry, and many others along the borders of the road answered it. A harsh horn blared, and there was the sound of running feet. But Tuor held on. He had learned enough of the tongue of the orcs in his captivity to know the meaning of those cries. The watchers had scented them and heard them, but they were not seen. The hunt was out. Desperately he stumbled and crept forward with Voronwë at his side, up a long slope deep in whin and whortleberry among knots of rowan and low birch. At the top of the ridge they halted, listening to the shouts behind and the crashing of the orcs in the undergrowth below. Beside them was a boulder that reared its head out of a tangle of heath and brambles, and beneath it was such a lair as a hunted beast might seek and hope there to escape pursuit, or at the least, with its back to stone, to sell its life dearly. Down into the dark shadow Tuor drew Voronwë, and side by side under the grey cloak they lay and panted like tired foxes. No word they spoke, all their heed was in their ears. The cries of the hunters grew fainter, for the orcs thrust never deep into the wild lands at either hand, but swept rather down and up the road. They recked little of stray fugitives, but spies they feared, and the scouts of armed foes, for Morgoth had set a guard on the highway, not to ensnare Tuor and Voronwë, of whom as yet he knew nothing, nor any coming from the west, but to watch for the Black Sword, lest he should escape and pursue the captives of Nargothrond, bringing help, it might be, out of Doriath. The night passed, and the brooding silence lay again upon the empty lands. Weary and spent, Tuor slept beneath Ulmo's cloak, but Voronwë crept forth and stood like a stone, silent, unmoving, piercing the shadows with his elvish eyes. At the break of day he woke Tuor, and he, creeping out, saw that the weather had indeed for a time relented, and the black clouds were rolled aside. There was a red dawn, and he could see far before him the tops of strange mountains glinting against the eastern fire. Then Voronwë said in a low voice, Alai, ered en ekoriath, ered embar nin. The encircling mountains, the mountains of my home. For he knew that he looked on the encircling mountains and the walls of the realm of Turgon. Below them, eastward in a deep and shadowy vale, lay Sirion the Fair, renowned in song. And beyond, wrapped in mist, a grey land climbed from the river to the broken hills at the mountain's feet. Yonder lies Dimbar, said Voronwë. Would we were there, for there our foes seldom dare to walk.
or so it was while the power of Ulmo was strong in Sirion. But all may now be changed, save the peril of the river. It is already deep and swift, and even for the Eldar dangerous to cross. But I have led you well, for there gleams the ford of Brithiach, yet a little southward, where the east road that of old ran all the way from Taras in the west made the passage of the river. None now dare to use it save in desperate need, neither elf nor man nor orc, since that road leads to Dungortheb, and the land of dread between the Gorgoroth and the girdle of Melian. And long since has it faded into the wild, or dwindled to a track among weeds and trailing thorns. Then Tuor looked as Voronwë pointed, and far away he caught the glimmer as of open waters under the brief light of dawn. But beyond loomed a darkness, where the great forest of Brethil climbed away southward into a distant highland. Now warily they made their way down the valley side, until at last they came to the ancient road descending from the Waymeet on the borders of Brethil, where it crossed the highway from Nargothrond. Then Tuor saw that they were come close to Sirion. The banks of its deep channel fell away in that place, and its waters, choked by a great waste of stones, were spread out into broad shallows, full of the murmur of fretting streams. Then, after a little, the river gathered together again, and delving a new bed, flowed away toward the forest, and far off vanished into a deep mist that his eye could not pierce. For there lay, though he knew it not, the north march of Doriath, within the shadow of the girdle of Melian. At once Tuor would hasten to the ford, but Voronwë restrained him, saying, "Over the Brithiach we may not go in open day, nor while any doubt of pursuit remains."
"Then shall we sit here and rot?" said Tuor. "For such doubt will remain while the realm of Morgoth endures. Come, under the shadow of the cloak of Ulmo we must go forward."
Still Voronwë hesitated, and looked back westward, but the track behind was deserted, and all about was quiet save for the rush of the waters. He looked up, and the sky was grey and empty, for not even a bird was moving. Then suddenly his face brightened with joy, and he cried aloud, "It is well! The Brithiach is guarded still by the enemies of the enemy. The orcs will not follow us here, and under the cloak we may pass now without more doubt."
"What new thing have you seen?" said Tuor.
"Short is the sight of mortal men," said Voronwë. "I see the eagles of the Chrysaigrim, and they are coming hither. Watch a while."
Then Tuor stood at gaze, and soon high in the air he saw three shapes beating on strong wings down from the distant mountain peaks now wreathed again in cloud. Slowly they descended in great circles, and then stooped suddenly upon the wayfarers. But before Voronwë could call to them, they turned with a wide sweep and rush, and flew northward along the line of the river.
"Now let us go," said Voronwë. "If there be any orc nearby, he will lie cowering nose to ground until the eagles have gone far away."
Swiftly down a long slope they hastened, and passed over the Brithiach, walking often dry-foot upon shelves of shingle, or wading in the shoals no more than knee-deep. The water was clear and very cold, and there was ice upon the shallow pools where the wandering streams had lost their way among the stones. But never, not even in the fell winter of the fall of Nargothrond, could the deadly breath of the north freeze the main flood of Sirion. On the far side of the ford they came to a gully, as it were the bed of an old stream, in which no water now flowed. Yet once it seemed a torrent had cloven its deep channel, coming down from the north out of the mountains of the Achoriath, and bearing thence all the stones of the Brithiach down into Sirion.
"At last, beyond hope we find it," cried Voronwë. "See, here is the mouth of the dry river, and that is the road we must take."
Then they passed into the gully, and as it turned north and the slopes of the land went steeply up, so its sides rose on either hand, and Tuor stumbled in the dim light among the stones with which its rough bed was strewn. "If this is a road," he said, "it is an evil one for the weary."
Yet it is the road to Turgon, said Voronwë.
Then the more do I marvel, said Tuor, that its entrance lies open and unguarded. I had looked to find a great gate and strength of guard.
That you shall yet see, said Voronwë. This is but the approach. A road, I named it. Yet upon it none have passed for more than 300 years, save messengers few and secret, and all the craft of the Noldor has been expended to conceal it, since the hidden people entered in.
Does it lie open? Would you have known it, if you had not had one of the hidden kingdom for a guide? Or would you have guessed it to be but the work of the weathers and the waters of the wilderness? And are there not the eagles, as you have seen? They are the folk of Thorondor, who dwelt once even on Thangorodrim, ere Morgoth grew so mighty, and dwell now in the mountains of Turgon since the fall of Fingolfin. They alone, save the Noldor, know the hidden kingdom and guard the skies above it, though as yet no servant of the enemy has dared to fly into the high airs. And they bring much news to the king of all that moves in the lands without. Had we been orcs, doubt not that we should have been seized and cast from a great height upon the pitiless rocks.
I doubt it not, said Tuor. But it comes into my mind to wonder also whether news will now not come to Turgon of our approach swifter than we. And if that be good or ill, you alone can say.
Neither good nor ill, said Voronwë. For we cannot pass the guarded gate unmarked, be we looked for or no. And if we come there, the guards will need no report that we are not orcs. But to pass, we shall need a greater plea than that. For you do not guess, Tuor, the peril that we then shall face. Blame me not as one unwarned for what may then betide. May the power of the Lord of Waters be shown indeed. For in that hope alone have I been willing to guide you. And if it fails, then more surely shall we die than by all the perils of wild and winter.
But Tuor said, Forebode no more. Death in the wild is certain, and death at the gate is yet in doubt to me for all your words. Lead me still on.
Many miles they toiled on in the stones of the dry river, until they could go no further, and the evening brought darkness into the deep cleft. They climbed out then onto the east bank, and they had now come into the tumbled hills that lay at the feet of the mountains. And looking up, Tuor saw that they towered up in a fashion other than that of any mountains that he had seen. For their sides were like sheer walls, piled each one above and behind the lower, as were they great towers of many-storied precipices. But the day had waned, and all the lands were grey and misty, and the vale of Sirion was shrouded in shadow. Then Voronwë led him to a shallow cave in a hillside that looked out over the lonely slopes of Dimbar. And they crept within, and there they lay hid. And they ate their last crumbs of food, and were cold and weary, but slept not. Thus did Tuor and Voronwë come in the dusk of the 18th day of Hissime, the 37th of their journey, to the towers of the Ikoriath and the threshold of Turgon, and by the power of Ulmo escaped both the doom and the malice. When the first glimmer of day filtered grey amid the mists of Dimbar, they crept back into the dry river, and soon after its course turned eastward, winding up to the very walls of the mountains, and straight before them there loomed a great precipice, rising sheer and sudden from a steep slope upon which grew a tangled thicket of thorn trees. Into this thicket the stony channel entered, and there it was still dark as night, and they halted, for the thorns grew far down the sides of the gully, and their lacing branches were a dense roof above it, so low that often Tuor and Voronwë must crawl under like beasts stealing back to their lair. But at last, as with great labour they came to the very foot of the cliff, they found an opening, as it were the mouth of a tunnel worn in the hard rock by waters flowing from the heart of the mountains. They entered, and within there was no light, but Voronwë went steadily forward, while Tuor followed with his hand upon his shoulder, bending a little, for the roof was low. Thus for a time they went on blindly, step by step, until presently they felt the ground beneath their feet had become level and free from loose stones. Then they halted and breathed deeply as they stood listening. The air seemed fresh and wholesome, and they were aware of a great space around and above them, but all was silent, and not even the drip of water could be heard. It seemed to Tuor that Voronwë was troubled and in doubt, and he whispered, "Where, then, is the guarded gate? Or have we indeed now passed it?"
"Nay," said Voronwë, "yet I wonder, for it is strange that any incomer should creep thus far unchallenged. I fear some stroke in the dark."
But their whispers aroused the sleeping echoes, and they were enlarged and multiplied, and ran in the roof and the unseen walls, hissing and murmuring as the sound of many stealthy voices. And even as the echoes died in the stone, Tuor heard out of the darkness a voice speak in the elven tongues, first in the high speech of the Noldor, which he knew not, and then in the tongue of Beleriand, though in a manner somewhat strange to his ears, as of a people long sundered from their kin. "Stand," it said, "stir not, or you will die, be you foes or friends."
"We are friends," said Voronwë.
"Then do as we bid," said the voice. The echo of their voices rolled into silence. Voronwë and Tuor stood still, and it seemed to Tuor that many slow minutes passed, and a fear was in his heart such as no other peril of his road had brought. Then there came the beat of feet, growing to a tramping loud as the march of trolls in that hollow place. Suddenly an elven lantern was unhooded, and its bright ray was turned upon Voronwë before him, but nothing else could Tuor see save a dazzling star in the darkness, and he knew that while that beam was upon him, he could not move, neither to flee nor to run forward. For a moment they were held thus in the eye of the light, and then the voice spoke again, saying, "Show your faces!" And Voronwë cast back his hood, and his face shone in the ray, hard and clear, as if graven in stone, and Tuor marvelled to see its beauty. Then he spoke proudly, saying, "Know you not whom you see? I am Voronwë, son of Oranwë of the House of Fingolfin, or am I forgotten in my own land after a few years? Far beyond the thought of Middle-earth I have wandered, yet I remember your voice, Elemakil."
"Then Voronwë will remember also the laws of his land," said the voice. "Since by command he went forth, he has the right to return, but not to lead hither any stranger. By that deed his right is void, and he must be led as a prisoner to the king's judgment. As for the stranger, he shall be slain or held captive at the judgment of the guard. Lead him hither that I may judge." Then Voronwë led Tuor towards the light, and as they drew near, many Noldor, mail-clad and armed, stepped forward out of the darkness and surrounded them with drawn swords. And Elemakil, captain of the guard, who bore the bright lamp, looked long and closely at them.
"This is strange in you, Voronwë," he said. "We were long friends. Why then would you set me thus cruelly between the law and my friendship? If you had led hither, unbidden, one of the other houses of the Noldor, that were enough. But you have brought to knowledge of the way a mortal man, for by his eyes I perceive his kin. Yet free can he never again go, knowing the secret. And as one of alien kin that has dared to enter, I should slay him, even though he be your friend and dear to you."
"In the wide lands without, Elemakil, many strange things may befall one, and tasks unlooked for be laid on one," Voronwë answered. "Other shall the wanderer return than as he set forth. What I have done under command greater than the law of the guard. The king alone should judge me, and him that comes with me."
Then Tuor spoke, and feared no longer. "I come with Voronwë, son of Oranwë, because he was appointed to be my guide by the Lord of Waters.
To this end was he delivered from the wrath of the sea and the doom of the Valar. For I bear from Ulmo an errand to the son of Fingolfin, and to him will I speak it. Thereat Elimakil looked in wonder upon Tuor. Who then are you? He said. And whence come you?
I am Tuor, son of Huor, of the house of Hador, and the kindred of Hurin. And these names, I am told, are not unknown in the Hidden Kingdom. From Nevrast I have come through many perils to seek it.
From Nevrast, said Elimakil. It is said that none dwell there since our people departed.
It is said truly, answered Tuor. Empty and cold stand the courts of Vinyamar. Yet thence I come. Bring me now to him that built those halls of old.
In matters so great, judgment is not mine, said Elimakil. Therefore I will lead you to the light where more may be revealed, and I will deliver you to the warden of the great gate. Then he spoke in command, and Tuor and Voronwë were set between tall guards, two before and three behind them. And their captain led them from the cavern of the outer guard, and they passed, as it seemed, into a straight passage, and there walked long upon a level floor until a pale light gleamed ahead. Thus they came at length to a wide arch with tall pillars upon either hand, hewn in the rock, and between hung a great portcullis of crossed wooden bars, marvellously carved and studded with nails of iron. Elimakil touched it, and it rose silently, and they passed through. And Tuor saw that they stood at the end of a ravine, the like of which he had never before beheld or imagined in his thought, long though he had walked in the wild mountains of the north. For beside the Orfalk Ekor, Kirith Niniach was but a groove in the rock. Here the hands of the Valar themselves, in ancient wars of the world's beginning, had wrested the great mountains asunder, and the sides of the rift were sheer as if axe-cloven, and they towered up to heights unguessable. There far aloft ran a ribbon of sky, and against its deep blue stood black peaks and jagged pinnacles, remote but hard, cruel as spears. Too high were those mighty walls for the winter sun to overlook, and though it was now full morning, faint stars glimmered above the mountain tops, and down below all was dim, but for the pale light of lamps set beside the climbing road. For the floor of the ravine sloped steeply up, eastward, and upon the left hand Tuor saw beside the stream bed a wide way, laid and paved with stone, winding upward till it vanished into shadow.
You have passed the first gate, the gate of wood, said Elimakil. There lies the way. We must hasten.
How far that deep road ran, Tuor could not guess, and as he stared onward a great weariness came upon him like a cloud. A chill wind hissed over the faces of the stones, and he drew his cloak about him.
Cold blows the wind from the Hidden Kingdom, he said.
Yea, indeed, said Voronwë. To a stranger it might seem that pride has made the servants of Turgon pitiless. Long and hard seem the leagues of the Seven Gates to the hungry and way-worn.
If our law were less stern, long ago guile and hatred would have entered and destroyed us, that you know well, said Elimakil. But we are not pitiless. Here there is no food, and the stranger may not go back through a gate that he has passed. Endure then a little, and at the second gate you shall be eased.
It is well, said Tuor, and he went forward as he was bidden.
After a little he turned and saw that Elimakil alone followed with Voronwë.
There is no need more of guards, said Elimakil, reading his thought. From the Orfalk there is no escape for elf or man, and no returning.
Thus they went on up the steep way, sometimes by long stairs, sometimes by winding slopes, under the daunting shadow of the cliff, until some half league from the wooden gate, Tuor saw that the way was barred by a great wall built across the ravine from side to side, with stout towers of stone at either hand. In the wall was a great archway above the road,
but it seemed that masons had blocked it with a single mighty stone. As they drew near, its dark and polished face gleamed in the light of a white lamp that hung above the midst of the arch.
"Here stands the second gate, the gate of stone," said Alamakiel. And going up to it, he thrust lightly upon it.
It turned upon an unseen pivot until its edge was towards them, and the way was open upon either side. And they passed through into a court where stood many armed guards clad in grey. No word was spoken, but Elamakiel led his charges to a chamber beneath the northern tower, and there food and wine was brought to them, and they were permitted to rest a while.
"Scant may the fare seem," said Elamakiel to Tuor, "but if your claim be proved, hereafter it shall richly be amended."
"It is enough," said Tuor. "Faint were the heart that needed better healing."
And indeed such refreshment did he find in the drink and food of the Noldor, that soon he was eager to go on. After a little space they came to a wall yet higher and stronger than before, and in it was set the third gate, the gate of bronze. A great twofold door hung with shields and plates of bronze, wherein were wrought many figures and strange signs. Upon the wall above its lintel were three square towers, roofed and clad with copper, that by some device of smithcraft were ever bright, and gleamed as fire in the rays of the red lamps ranged like torches along the wall. Again silently they passed the gate, and saw in the court beyond a yet greater company of guards in mail that glowed like dull fire, and the blades of their axes were red. Of the kindred of the Sindar of Nevrast, for the most part, were those that held this gate. Now they came to the most toilsome road, for in the midst of the Orfalch the slope was at the steepest, and as they climbed, Tuor saw the mightiest of the walls looming dark above him. Thus, at last, they drew near the fourth gate, the gate of writhen iron. High and black was the wall, and lit with no lamps. Four towers of iron stood upon it, and between the two inner towers was set an image of a great eagle wrought in iron, even the likeness of King Thorondor himself, as he would alight upon a mountain from the high airs. But as Tuor stood before the gate, it seemed to his wonder that he was looking through boughs and stems of imperishable trees into a pale glade of the moon. For a light came through the traceries of the gate, which were wrought and hammered into the shapes of trees with writhing roots and woven branches, laden with leaves and flowers. And as he passed through, he saw how this could be, for the wall was of great thickness, and there was not one grille, but three in line, so set that to one who approached in the middle of the way, each formed part of the device. But the light beyond was the light of day. For they had climbed now to a great height above the lowlands where they began, and beyond the iron gate the road ran almost level. Moreover, they had passed the crown and heart of the Ekoriath, and the mountain towers now fell swiftly down towards the inner hills, and the ravine opened wider, and its sides became less sheer. Its long shoulders were mantled with white snow, and the light of the sky snow-mirrored came white as moonlight through a glimmering mist that filled the air. Now they passed through the lines of the iron guards that stood behind the gate. Black were their mantles and their mail and long shields, and their faces were masked with visors bearing an eagle's beak. Then Elamakiel went before them, and they followed him into the pale light. And Tuor saw beside the way a sward of grass, where like stars bloomed the white flowers of Uilos, the ever-mind that knows no season and withers not. And thus, in wonder and lightening of heart, he was brought to the gate of silver. The wall of the fifth gate was built of white marble, and was low and broad, and its parapet was a trellis of silver between five great globes of marble, and there stood many archers robed in white. The gate was in shape as three parts of a circle, and wrought of silver and pearl of Nevrast in likeness of the moon. but above the gate upon the midmost globe stood an image of the white tree Telperion, wrought of silver and malachite, with flowers made of great pearls of Balar. And beyond the gate, in a wide court paved with marble, green and white, stood archers in silver mail and white-crested helms, 100 upon either hand. Then Elamachiel led Tuor and Voronwe through their silent ranks, and they entered upon a long white road that ran straight towards the sixth gate. And as they went, the grass sward became wider, and among the white stars of Uilos there opened many small flowers like eyes of gold. So they came to the Golden Gate, the last of the ancient gates of Turgon that were wrought before the Nirnaeth. And it was much like the gate of silver, save that the wall was built of yellow marble, and the globes and parapet were of red gold, and there were six globes, and in the midst upon a golden pyramid was set an image of Laurelin, the tree of the sun, with flowers wrought of topaz in long clusters upon chains of gold. And the gate itself was adorned with discs of gold many rayed, in likenesses of the sun, set amid devices of garnet and topaz and yellow diamonds. In the court beyond were arrayed 300 archers with long bows, and their mail was gilded, and tall golden plumes rose from their helmets, and their great round shields were red as flame. Now sunlight fell upon the further road, for the walls of the hills were low on either side, and green, but for the snows upon their tops. And Elamachiel hastened forward, for the way was short to the seventh gate, named the Great, the gate of steel that Maeglin wrought after the return from the Nirnaeth, across the wide entrance to the Orfalch Ekor. No wall stood there, but on either hand were two round towers of great height, many-windowed, tapering in seven stories to a turret of bright steel. And between the towers there stood a mighty fence of steel that rusted not, but glittered cold and white. Seven great pillars of steel there were, tall with the height and girth of strong young trees, but ending in a bitter spike that rose to the sharpness of a needle. And between the pillars were seven crossbars of steel, and in each space seven times seven rods of steel upright with heads like the broad blades of spears. But in the centre, above the midmost pillar and the greatest, was raised a mighty image of the king helm of Turgon, the crown of the hidden kingdom, set about with diamonds. No gate or door could Tuor see in this mighty hedge of steel, but as he drew near through the spaces between the bars, there came, as it seemed to him, a dazzling light, and he shaded his eyes and stood still in dread and wonder. But Elamachiel went forward, and no gate opened to his touch, but he struck upon a bar, and the fence rang like a harp of many strings, giving forth clear notes in harmony that ran from tower to tower. Straightway there issued riders from the towers, but before those of the north tower came one upon a white horse, and he dismounted and strode towards them. And high and noble as was Elamachiel, greater and more lordly was Ecthelion, lord of the fountains, at that time warden of the great gate. All in silver was he clad, and upon his shining helm was set a spike of steel pointed with a diamond, and as his esquire took his shield, it shimmered as if it were bedewed with drops of rain, that were indeed 1,000 studs of crystal. Elamachiel saluted him and said, "Here have I brought Voronwe Aranwion, returning from Balar, and here is the stranger that he has led hither, who demands to see the king." Then Ecthelion turned to Tuor, but he drew his cloak about him and stood silent, facing him. And it seemed to Voronwe that a mist mantled Tuor, and his stature was increased, so that the peak of his high hood overtopped the helm of the elf lord, as it were the crest of a grey sea wave riding to the land. But Ecthelion bent his bright glance upon Tuor, and after a silence he spoke gravely, saying,
"At this point, The carefully written manuscript ends, and there follows only a rough text scribbled on a scrap of paper.
You have come to the last gate. Know then that no stranger who passes it shall ever go out again, save by the door of death.
Speak not ill-boding. If the messenger of the Lord of Waters go by that door, then all those who dwell here will follow him. Lord of the Fountains, hinder not the messenger of the Lord of Waters.
Then Voronwe and all those who stood near looked again in wonder at Tuor, marvelling at his words and voice. And to Voronwe it seemed as if he heard a great voice, but as of one who called from afar off. But to Tuor it seemed that he listened to himself speaking, as if another spoke with his mouth. For a while Ecthelion stood silent, looking at Tuor, and slowly awe filled his face, as if in the grey shadow of Tuor's cloak he saw visions from far away. Then he bowed, and went to the fence and laid hands upon it, and gates opened inward on either side of the pillar of the crown. Then Tuor passed through, and coming to a high sward that looked out over the valley beyond, he beheld a vision of Gondolin amid the white snow. And so entranced was he that for long he could look at nothing else. For he saw before him at last the vision of his desire out of dreams of longing. Thus he stood and spoke no word. Silent upon either hand stood a host of the army of Gondolin. All of the seven kinds of the seven gates were there represented, but their captains and chieftains were upon horses, white and grey. Then, even as they gazed on Tuor in wonder, his cloak fell, and he stood there before them in the mighty livery of Nevrast. And many were there who had seen Turgon himself set these things upon the wall behind the high seat of Vinyamar. Then Ecthelion said at last, "Now no further proof is needed, and even the name he claims as son of Huor matters less than this clear proof that he comes from Ulmo himself."
Here this text comes to an end, but there follow some rapidly written notes, sketching out elements of the narrative as my father at that time foresaw it. Tuor asked the name of the city, and was told its seven names. See the tale of the fall of Gondolin. Ecthelion gave orders for the sounding of the signal, and trumpets were blown on the towers of the great gate. Then answering trumpets were heard, blown far off on the city walls. On horseback they rode to the city, of which a description was to follow, of the great gate, the trees, the place of the fountain, and of the king's house. And then would be described the welcome of Tuor by Turgon. Beside the throne would be seen Maeglin on the right and Idril on the left, and Tuor would declare the message of Ulmo. There is also a note saying that there was to be a description of the city as Tuor saw it from afar, and that it was to be recounted why there was no queen of Gondolin. The evolution of the story. These notes, i.e. at the end of the latest Tuor manuscript, are of slight significance in the history of the legend of the fall of Gondolin, but they show at least that my father did not abandon this work in some sudden, unlooked-for haste, never to take it up again. But any idea that a further fully evolved continuation of the story, after Ecthelion's words to Tuor at the seventh gate of Gondolin, has been lost, is out of the question. So, there we have it. My father did indeed abandon this essential and, one may say, definitive form and treatment of the legend, at the very moment when he had brought Tuor at long last to behold a vision of Gondolin amid the white snow. For me, it is perhaps the most grievous of his many abandonments. Why did he stop there? An answer of a kind can be found. This was a deeply distressing time for him, a time of intense frustration. It can be said with certainty that when the Lord of the Rings was at last completed, he returned to the legends of the elder days with a strong new energy. I will cite here parts of a remarkable letter that he wrote to Sir Stanley Unwin, the chairman of Allen & Unwin, on the 24th of February 1950, for it clearly presents the prospect of publishing as he saw it at that time.
In one of your more recent letters, you expressed a desire still to see the manuscript of my proposed work, The Lord of the Rings, originally expected to be a sequel to The Hobbit. For 18 months now, I have been hoping for the day when I could call it finished. But it was not until after Christmas, 1949, that this goal was reached at last. It is finished, if still partly unrevised, and is, I suppose, in a condition which a reader could read, if he did not wilt at the sight of it. As the estimate for typing a fair copy was in the neighbourhood of £100, which I have not to spare, I was obliged to do nearly all myself. And now I look at it, the magnitude of the disaster is apparent to me. My work has escaped from my control, and I have produced a monster. An immensely long, complex, rather bitter, and very terrifying romance, quite unfit for children, if fit for anybody, and it is not really a sequel to The Hobbit, but to The Silmarillion. My estimate is that it contains, even without certain necessary adjuncts, about 600,000 words. One typist put it even higher. I can see only too clearly how impracticable this is. But I am tired. It is off my chest, and I do not feel that I can do anything more about it beyond a little revision of inaccuracies. Worse still, I feel that it is tied to The Silmarillion. You may perhaps remember about that work, a long legendary of imaginary times in a high style and full of elves, of a sort. It was rejected on the advice of your reader many years ago. As far as my memory goes, he allowed it a kind of Celtic beauty, intolerable to Anglo-Saxons in large doses.
The reader had, in fact, only seen a few pages of The Silmarillion, although he did not know this. As I have mentioned in Beren and Lúthien, he contrasted those pages greatly to the detriment of the Lay of Lathian, having no understanding of their relationship. And in his enthusiasm for The Silmarillion pages, he said, absurdly, that the tale is told with a picturesque brevity and dignity that holds the reader's interest, in spite of its eye-splitting Celtic names. It has something of that mad, bright-eyed beauty that perplexes all Anglo-Saxons in the face of Celtic art.
He was probably perfectly right and just, and you commented that it was a work to be drawn upon rather than published. Unfortunately, I am not an Anglo-Saxon, and though shelved until a year ago, The Silmarillion and all that has refused to be suppressed. It has bubbled up, infiltrated, and probably spoiled everything that even remotely approached fairy, which I have tried to write since. It was kept out of Farmer Giles with an effort, but stopped the continuation. Its shadow was deep on the later parts of The Hobbit. It has captured The Lord of the Rings, so that that has become simply its continuation and completion, requiring The Silmarillion to be fully intelligible, without a lot of references and explanations that clutter it in one or two places. Ridiculous and tiresome as you may think me, I want to publish them both, The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings, in conjunction or in connection. I want to. It would be wiser to say I should like to, since a little packet of, say, 1,000,000 words of matter set out in extenso that Anglo-Saxons or the English-speaking public can only endure in moderation is not very likely to see the light, even if paper were available at will. All the same, that is what I should like. Or I will let it all be. I cannot contemplate any drastic rewriting or compression. Of course, being a writer, I should like to see my words printed. But there they are. For me, the chief thing is that I feel that the whole matter is now exorcised and rides me no more. I can turn now to other things.
I will not follow the intricate and painful history through the next 2 years. My father never relinquished his opinion, in his words in another letter, that The Silmarillion, etc., and the Lord of the Rings went together as one long saga of the jewels and the rings.
I was resolved to treat them as one thing, however they might formally be issued.
But the costs of production of such a huge work, in the years after the war, were hopelessly against him. On the 22nd of June 1952, he wrote to Rainer Unwin.
As for the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, they are where they were. The one finished and the end revised, and the other still unfinished, or unrevised, and both gathering dust. I have been, off and on, too unwell and too burdened to do much about them, and too downhearted, watching paper shortages and costs mounting against me. But I have rather modified my views. Better something than nothing. Although to me all are one, and the Lord of the Rings would be better far, and eased as part of the whole, I would gladly consider the publication of any part of this stuff. Years are becoming precious, and retirement, not far off, will, as far as I can see, bring not leisure but a poverty that will necessitate scraping a living by examining and such like tasks.
As I said in Morgoth's Ring, thus he bowed to necessity, but it was a grief to him. I believe that the explanation of his abandonment of the last version is to be found in the extracts of correspondence given above. In the first place, there are his words in his letter to Stanley Unwin of the 24th of February 1950. He announced firmly that The Lord of the Rings was finished.
After Christmas, this goal was reached at last.
And he said,
"For me, the chief thing is that I feel that the whole matter is now exorcised and rides me no more. I can turn now to other things."
In the second place, there is an essential date. The page of the manuscript of the last version of Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin, carrying notes of elements in the story that were never reached in that text, was a page of an engagement calendar for September 1951, and other pages from this calendar were used for rewriting passages. In the foreword to Morgoth's Ring, I wrote, "But little of all the work begun at that time was completed." The new lay of Lathian